everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Southern Fried Podcast. I'm Rex Nelson of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and thank you for joining us yet again for this Democrat Gazette production as we bring in some of the most interesting folks in Arkansas. See, I'm putting the pressure on you already. Brent, you got to be interesting this morning. Old friend Brent Birch, Little Rock Technology Park Director, is my guest this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Rex, good to see you again, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're gonna go on two levels today. We're going to spend about a half the show on your vocation, which is the technology park, and then we're going to spend about half the show on your avocation, which is duck hunting.
Yep.
Because we've got a season coming up, and you're one of the state's experts on that. I've written a book about the Grand Prairie at the Greenhead magazine. I could go on and on. So we'll start technology, and then we'll transition into hunting, if you're good with that.
Perfect.
Good. For those that might not be familiar, I've written a lot about it through the years, as you know, but those that might not be familiar, tell me a little bit about the Tech Park, its history, how it got to be here in Little Rock, and where it is in Little Rock.
Yeah, it's got a long story as far as how it was kind of created. It took a long time to get to actually being an entity that people could actually touch and feel, so to speak. It came about mainly because of the generation of research and commercialization of research coming off of UMS and UALR's campuses. And Little Rock was trying to capture that, those companies that were being birthed out of the research side of things on those campuses, and retain them versus them leaving to go to Dallas or St. Louis or Nashville or other area regional competitors that had research and lab space. Because once they commercialize, they've got to move off of a campus and,
right,
and be a business and stand up on their own. So that was the original generation of this. It took a long time to get there. Finally, through countless volunteer hours by the late Dixon Flake. And then, of course, our current chamber president, Jay Cheshire, were kind of the two that really drove that project to get to where it did, and got some legislation passed that created it was a Research Park Authority Act that allowed you to stand up an entity like this. They also worked really hard to get the city of Little Rock behind it, UMS and ULR sponsors, and then Arkansas Children's Hospital was a kind of a quasi-sponsor. So those entities helped really keep pushing it along, and then finally got to a point where the board was formed. And then I came on board a few years even after the board was formed. They just spent a lot of time researching where it should be. And that's what a lot of people remember about
the
project.
Right, right. A lot of stories generated in this newspaper about where that location should be.
Yeah, that caused some controversy early on when they were wanting to possibly bolt it on to the UALR campus or the UMS campus, especially on the UALR side, because everybody knows that campus is pretty much landlocked.
It is
to where it is, and so it would have caused some differences in what people thought should be done with the area around there, and that forced the board to step back. And that's probably the best thing that ever happened, because it allowed them to adjust the priorities of maybe where this should be. And they looked at several properties all up and down 630 either side of it, but settled on downtown, and that was truly a blessing because downtown is where it needs to be and should be.
Well, our offices here at the Democrat Gazette are, of course, just a block away from you. We're taping downtown. I work downtown, so I'm a fan of downtown. But you said it's where it should be. Elaborate on that a little bit. Why should this be in downtown Little Rock?
Yeah, well, one, downtown Little Rock needs it. It needs that vibrancy. It's you know, especially with the government exodus from downtown,
right,
which is, frankly, it's hurt the downtown market.
It has, especially as state government has moved more and more to the old Altel complex down in Riverdale.
That's right. So the rest of what you've got downtown is banks and law firms, and so the energy of the tech park and the tenants that are within it changes the dynamic. And you can talk to Chris Tanner at Samantha's. That's a big reason he put Samantha's where it is, on, you know, in the corner of 3rd and Main, or 4th and Main, sorry, on the 300 block. He wanted to be close to the energy that the tech park has created. And you think about taking, you know, one of the buildings we own, we still lease to the Department of Education, even though they won't be there that much longer. And then the two buildings buildings we renovated, one of them was empty, had been empty since Stevens had moved to Center Street into the big skyscraper. We took a building down that had been vacant even prior to that, that they were in, which was the original Stevens headquarters, and then renovated a building that Richard Mays owned that had, you know, had limited stuff done to it. And so brought some, truly some life back to the 400 block, which, I, like I said, I think is influenced was what has happened in the 300 block with the restaurants.
Oh, I agree. And again, I, as I said, my office, of course, walking distance, but the 300 block, that is a block you and I remember as recently as a decade ago that was pretty desolate. It now has six restaurants on that one block, three on one side and three on the other side.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty interesting. At my first job out of college, I went to work for the Worthen Banking Corporation, which was the holding company at the time. You know, Worthen was blowing and going. They had just bought Union, if people remember that. That is right when I started. And so I worked in the building that Samantha's is in. I worked on the seventh floor of that building.
I'll be.
They call it the WAC building, the Worthen Administration Center. And, you know, there was nothing there. The News Mart was around the corner.
Right.
You know, a couple other little things there, but it was pretty dark, dingy block. And now it is a totally different scene. So, yeah, I have memories back to the mid-90s of what that used to be and where it is now. It's night and day.
Same here. I came to work in this building the first time in December of 1981. So go back even before and watch that decline and now the revitalization. And I have to agree with you. The Tech Park has played a role in that. And I know you have been real pleased with your occupancy rates as you filled up before the pandemic. Talk about how that occurred and then how the pandemic has maybe affected you over the last year and a half.
The occupancy rate was we were completely full and had been for probably 10, 11 months pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. Now, people would leave, but as soon as they would leave, there was a waiting list built in.
Somebody new would come in.
And we are limited in the space of the building that we're, you know, the current phase one building to where we started looking at phase two even. But it definitely justified the project, that there was a need in the Central Arkansas community for the technology focused companies, entrepreneurs, workers in that industry that needed a kind of a hub to operate out of. And so that phase one building definitely justified that. Then we started looking, okay, with this building full, we've got to start looking forward to phase two. And so we went through the whole process of even designing and getting costs back on a building that we were going to put in the parking lot between the phase one building and KTV's building, the original Worthen Bank building,
right,
where the Center Theater used to be. So we went through that whole process. We're geared up, ready to go with that and start raising the funds to do that. And then the pandemic hit. And so we obviously put the brakes on that, but then we also suffered some vacancy, some exodus by tenants naturally that weren't either comfortable with coming in the office, weren't able to afford the rent because their business had slowed. But we also had a strong contingency of people that hung on to their space and didn't want to let it go because once this was over, they didn't want to give up what they had.
Right.
They didn't want to mess with changing even something as simple as mailing addresses during all this. So they hung on to their space. So we were still able to keep a core group as tenants. And there was a solid group that kept coming despite, you know, everything going on during the height of all this. And so that allowed us to keep operationally strong through this. And now we're on the other side of it where we've almost filled the space back up again. And we've shifted gears on what we're going to do phase two. It's not a done deal, but you know, the odds are we're going to go in, and now that we've learned that the Department of Education is going to move out of our building here right across the street on the corner of Capitol and Main, we'll go in and renovate that building, and that'll likely be our phase two.
So you will just move down the street, down Main Street.
Yeah, which was a natural progression for us to keep this contiguous kind of campus built, but we'll do the space differently.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's not a done deal. The board has not formally approved that, but that's the direction we're moving. We're working with architect on figuring out how much that's going to cost and things like that. So it'd be a natural fit. We don't want to leave that building unoccupied because when the Department of Ed moves out, we want to be able to backfill in with our tenant.
Realizing that there can be curveballs in life, and I'm using the analogy on purpose since you're no baseball pitcher.
Sure.
But there can be curveballs. None of us saw the pandemic coming, of course. But putting that aside, give me kind of your best guess on where you see the technology park maybe 2 years from now, 5 years from now, and even 10 years from now.
Yeah, and that's interesting because, as everybody knows, technology changes very rapidly. Mm-hmm. There's probably a technology bubbling up out there that we don't even know about yet, because we've seen some kind of come and go since we've opened that building in 2017. I mean, the whole Bitcoin and all of those kind of cryptocurrencies, there was a couple of companies that have come and gone in our space because of that. So there's something out there that we don't know about. But in 2 years, I would hope we've secured kind of an anchor tenant, just a little bit bigger tech company or a satellite office of a large tech company that wants a Little Rock presence. I hope we've secured an anchor tenant to kind of build around that could almost serve as an upstream. And maybe they're in the tech park, and maybe they're cherry picking companies that are bubbling up in there to kind of absorb them into their world, because that's really worked well with the FinTech Accelerator. You've seen some of the large banks come in and kind of cherry pick technologies and absorb those back up into their, underneath their banking umbrella. But as we all know, technology in banking is everyday thing now. And I would hope that we're there. And then with the 5-year plan, I hope we've seen some exits, notable exits by some companies. We've had some good ones, some good success stories. Apogee was an early one that he started in our space when we were on Markham while the current phase one building was being renovated. And it was just him. And then all of a sudden it was him and 3 or 4 people. And then it was him and 6 or 7 people. And in that space, we didn't have room to accommodate him. And the tech park, as it stands today, wasn't available. So he had to move out. And within a year of that, he had like 100 employees. And now he's already moved again and is now kind of down where in the old Cajun's Wharf, ballpark.
Right.
And he's got like over 200 employees.
Wow.
So, and that's stuff a lot of people don't hear about, but he's built this entire platform around communication and marketing within schools and sells his product across the country. And we've had a couple other good ones. Alleviant Health was another one that was in the telemedicine space that justified them being in our building. They've exited and now have... I don't know how many square feet in where the old Kmart used to be, where that gastroenterology clinic is. They've got a pretty good sized chunk of space in there.
Rodney Parham,
more than we could provide them in our current building. And there's been a couple more. We've had some companies get sold. We had a company in there that was formerly Sumo Text, and then it was IMI Mobile. They sold to Cisco, which is a large technology provider. So there's been some really nice success stories. So we want to keep generating more of those. But what we like to see is one of those companies bubble up and get so big, similar to Apogee, they move out of here, but they stay in Little Rock.
They stay here. Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, good luck going forward. I think it's great for Little Rock. I think it's great for downtown. Love having you around the corner, and keep me in touch. I'll keep writing a lot in the future because really, really sold on what you're trying to do and think it's a real important part of where this city goes going forward. All right, I'm going to make that transition now. As you know, I contact you sometimes when I'm doing a duck hunting column. Of course, we've got a Brian Hendricks, a great outdoor editor here at the Democrat Gazette, and he does the actual hunting stories and ammunition and guns and the nitty gritty. My columns are more culture and history, and duck hunting is just part of the cultural fabric of Arkansas, which is why I write about it a lot. It's part of our culture, has its own unique culture, rich history. Talk a little bit, first of all, about your personal history, how you grew up and that being part of your winters growing up.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to tag along with my dad. He worked at the original Twin City Bank.
Right.
And they had a lodge. The Franklin family owned Twin City Bank at the time. They owned a John Deere dealership. They owned the Coca-Cola bottler. And they had a lodge, which was Franklin Jr.'s club prior to him buying Wingmead.
Wingmead, which is the most famous of the Arkansas duck clubs, I'd have to say, about history.
Yeah. No question. But when he bought Wingmead, he transitioned the Crockett's Bluff Lodge to a corporate club. So the companies that he owned, they split the days, and that's where they took customers. And so I got to tag along with my dad as he would
TCB days.
That's right. On the TCB days, to get to go down there, and while he entertained clients and everything else, I got to run around with the guides, and of course get to hunt. You know, every time we went down there, and it's a cool historic place too. It's on the National Historic Register. Really neat place. Hunting the old Oxbow Lakes of the White River Bottoms. Mm-hmm. That was my introduction to it, and obviously now 46 years later, still laid up with it.
Well, like I said, you write about it a lot. First of all, talk about Greenhead Magazine, then I want to get into your Grand Prairie book a little bit, but talk about the magazine that you do every year.
Yeah, that was my previous job before the Tech Park. I was the Chief Information Officer at Arkansas Business Publishing Group, and we kind of came up with the concept. There were a couple of other duck hunters in the company at the time that nobody was really writing about Arkansas duck hunting, just Arkansas, not trying to be anything to everybody. Narrowly focused on Arkansas, and given we're the duck capital of the world, we felt there would be a justification for national advertising in there, enough local advertising, and then obviously plenty of editorial content to write about. So we launched it, and now it's 11 years later. It's an annual magazine that comes out. 11 years later, we're still doing it, and it's
and
probably,
even though you left that job, you kept doing the magazine.
That's right. I'm still editor. Pretty much have my hands in all except the sales side. I'll refer them companies I run across or people I run across that would be interested, but I don't handle any of the sales piece. But the editorial side of things, kind of direct all that, kind of come up with the concepts for the stories, and then I usually write two or three a year. Mostly either written about conservation or things going on in that world, or some of the historical pieces. Those are the two I like to write about the most.
Now, I mentioned that I was going to talk about the book. As you know, because I've written about it a lot, my mother's from Des Arc on the Grand Prairie. I used to spend large parts of my summers at my grandparents' house in Des Arc in the holidays. So I have a real place in my family roots, in my heart for it. You did a book on that region of the state. And again, it wasn't just hunting. I mean, duck hunting was kind of the theme, but you expanded that into the whole culture, history of the region, famous restaurants, on and on. Talk a little bit about that and why you kind of expanded it into more than just a here's where you go duck hunting book.
Yeah, that was an awesome project. Just to be able to, I've hunted on the Grand Prairie my entire life and learned so many things about people, places, things that I didn't know about. And my hope is everybody that read the book did the same, because there's truly not another place on the planet that has the rich cultural history that the Grand Prairie has. Mm-hmm. And it got to be a point, it was Whit Stevens Jr. who came to me about writing the book. We had a mutual interest in the heritage and the history of things. And he called me to his office one day and wanted to have lunch. And I didn't know the title other than we were going to talk about duck hunting. And he brought it up. We need to do a book about this place, about the history and the culture and the traditions of this area before some of these people start fading away. Mm-hmm. Plenty of them already have. And the timing was right to pull that off, because I still have, through the magazine and through my personal experiences, I had a lot of connections on the prairie.
Right.
Well, now after writing the book, I have even more. But you talk to one person who's, you ought to talk to so-and-so. And that network, Arkansas, I've said a few times, I've heard other people say it too, it's a two phone call state. I may not have the governor's number, but I can call you and you can probably give me the governor.
That's right.
You can
get to somebody in two calls. Yeah.
The prairie definitely works that way. And so the access to be able to write about places that haven't been in any of these other books and talk about people that haven't been in any of these other books. Because a lot of the previous books, now the Duck Hunter's Almanac was unbelievable, but it was the whole state. Mm-hmm. And that covered everything, but it was still mainly duck hunting geared towards the duck hunting.
Right, right.
And then there's been a couple books come out of Memphis that are more about the clubs. And I wanted to write about all the other cool stuff I know that goes on in that part of the world, places to eat.
Making calls, on and on. Yeah, yeah.
All decoys, those pieces that truly identify the Grand Prairie as the epicenter of duck hunting. Mm-hmm. The reason I said the timing was right, I think part of it because of social media and some of the things that has generated, I think we've gotten away from some of the traditions and respect of the long haul of the sport of waterfowling versus, you know, how fast can we kill them? How fast can I get my picture with all my buddies up on social media? Not really necessarily respecting what came before that's made this sport have the longevity it has, despite trying to hunt a wild animal that lives somewhere else most of the year, mm-hmm. You know, has babies somewhere else, long ways away, spends its winter down here. It's not something that's around all the time, like deer or, you know, some other animals that are hunted and harvested in Arkansas. So it's a part of it is a hope too that maybe some younger generation reads that book and understands. You know, this thing doesn't necessarily last forever. There's been some dips in duck season, and we may be facing another one
right
coming up. We've come off a couple tough seasons, and things don't sound great. We're probably kind of a little bit spoiled.
We are spoiled.
Nobody's going to feel sorry for us on our mallard harvest. If you talk to anybody in another state,
we're going to be the top mallard state, even if we think it's an awful year.
That's right.
You know, you have written about, and I enjoy how you have covered it in Greenhead and elsewhere. You know, duck hunters are no different than anybody else. You get into conspiracy theories and you try to come with one thing. They're planting corn up in Missouri and Iowa and leaving it in the fields and flooding them, and that's holding all the ducks and yada, yada, yada. And you have written extensively about just how complex this is and how hard it is to make those estimates on what kind of year it's going to be. There's no single one factor, is there? There's a whole bunch of factors that play into what kind of season you're going
to
have.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And people want to simplify it down to those things. You know, it's the weather. It doesn't get cold enough anymore. Or it's, you know, they're planting corn and leaving corn and they're heated ponds and things in north of us and ducks never get here. Those are factors, but not the single driving factors. Not even weather is the single driving factor. It's got so much more to do that. And then I wrote it turned out to be a really good piece in this current Greenhead about
right.
some of the factors that are driving it. And you add them all up and then, yeah, if all those things happen, that's why the seasons aren't very good. That's why we're not seeing the number of ducks. You know, one of those factors comes in. This year, supposedly the breeding is poor. Dry, super dry in Canada, super dry in the Dakotas. But if we get the right weather that pushes the ducks, that's going to make them here. Now, whether that we're going to see them during daylight, mm-hmm. that's another question. Mm-hmm. Because we as hunters are putting a lot of pressure on the modern day mallard. And that's driving them to be nocturnal. Everybody's seeing it. You know, 30 minutes after shooting time, the sky's full of ducks. But that's because the ducks have gotten smart. Because the hunter has pressured the duck, you know, pushing it about as hard as we can push it. And that's something we can actually control. We can't control corn planted up north. Definitely can't control the weather. Now, you can control easing off on the duck. And this new trend in scouting, you know, people ride in the woods all day in boats kicking ducks up. That's not good for the sport. That's mm-hmm. not good for the longevity of keeping ducks in the area. You know, shooting these, I've seen these speckle-belly goose hunts that are taking 20 and 30 guns in there. That's not good. That's not mm-hmm. good for the longevity. That's mm-hmm. that's a short, narrow thinking about where we're going to be
right.
in a couple of years. So things like that, hunters, big thing for me is control what you can control. You can control whether you shoot a drake or a hen. This year, we probably need to be shooting drakes.
I agree.
The hens have had a tough, mm-hmm. tough time on the prairie because when it's dry, predators have easier access to them. So if we want to see some rebound in population, maybe we should let the mamas make it back to Canada and we get the right conditions up there. A drought, you know, not a drought, but a really wet spring. We put enough mamas back on the prairie, that prairie, maybe we see an explosion in population again. But if we just blatantly go trying to fill a limit and we shoot hens, drakes, doesn't matter, you're taking those out of the equation, we might be looking at some flatlining or some downturns mm-hmm. population-wise.
Good point. One other issue I want to hit with you because it's been in the news a lot lately. Of course, one of the things that made Arkansas the duck hunting capital of the world were our great public hunting lands that allowed people to come here from all over the country and literally around the world and hunt. And of those lands, it was really the green timber area that were flooded that made those most famous places like Biomeda Wildlife Management Area. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission have really started, at least in the last year, taking a lot of legislators out, taking a lot of people out, and have made very clear that we've got real problems with our hardwoods in those areas dying off, that the water's staying on them too long, and it's not going to be cheap to remedy that, and they're going to have to find new sources of income to do that. Talk a little bit about that situation.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to go on two tours of Biomeda, one this spring and one in the early summer, and have had extensive conversations with several commissioners that I know personally that I consider friends. And then I've had lunch with Austin Booth, our new Game and Fish director, and have had lots of conversations with him about it. The damage is real. This isn't the Game and Fish trying to, a lot of people have the opinion that
they're favoring private
land hunters now. Yeah. That's not the case. I've seen it with my own eyes. Those woods are in trouble. Yeah. Hurricane is really in trouble.
Yeah, they're stressed, aren't they? Yeah.
In bad shape. But, you know, we were going in there. I can't remember the exact timing, but the amount of water that was still being held in Biomeda in the early summer was really disturbing, and they can't get it off.
Right, and those oaks should be on dry land by that point of the year.
That's right. Now they've got I am fully convinced they have a great plan in place, and some hunting is going to suffer because of it. And I'm interested. I mean, me personally, I'm interested. I along with some partners own a farm just north of Upper Valier, just north of Hallowell. Well, that's going to be part that's going to be probably dry most of the season, unless we get some kind of huge rain based on this new flooding schedule that they're going to use. And how's that going to impact the ducks? I mean, are we still going to get ducks? Where are those ducks going to go that were going to Upper Valier and to Hallowell? Where are they going to go now? It's going to be interesting, but it's a make or break deal. A hard decision they had to make to do that, and some hunters are going to be impacted, but there was not going to be any hunting if they didn't make a change.
Right.
Now they still got to find money to redo some of the water control structures to make it act more natural. They didn't know what they didn't know back when they did them, and now, just like everything else, we figure out better ways to do things and get smarter about things as time goes by. And they did some things wrong, and the Game and Fish is the first to admit it. But now they've got a plan in place that's going to remedy a lot of that. And they had to make that decision now for Biomeda to have a chance. Hurricane is probably past having a chance. It's going to have to be a rebuild kind of deal. And they've identified some ways to do that. But Biomeda's still got a chance to hang in there and be okay. But if those changes weren't made and those decisions, those tough decisions weren't made, we're looking at Biomeda not being anything remotely close to what we all have known for all this time.
Yeah. And again, talk about a part of our Arkansas culture. So bottom line for hunters, especially those who hunt public lands, there's going to have to be short-term sacrifice, short-term being over several seasons probably, in order to ensure long-term survival.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's the way they got to look at it. And I get it. You know, not being a public land hunter, I can definitely feel for the situation. But you can't take what you're going to miss out on this season for something. If we didn't make the change, you miss out on forever. And your children and grandchildren may miss out on forever because those things aren't easy to get back. You can't grow. You can't go plant 100-foot tall red oaks. They don't exist. And so to see the damage that we saw this summer going in there, you think about that. If all this went untouched and it just continued to go the route it was going, I mean, you'd be looking at a big dead stick reservoir.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody wants that.
No, not at all. Well, we're only about a month away, so we're close enough. I can say have a good season.
Yeah.
Brent, thank you for joining us today.
Appreciate you having me.
Really enjoyed the discussion. Interesting combination. We do technology and duck hunting today. I enjoyed that. We'll have you back sometime if you don't mind.
Yeah, we can always next time we can throw Razorback baseball.
Absolutely. Maybe get you back in the spring. That's a good idea. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Southern Fried Podcast. I'm Rex Nelson of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. We'll see you next time.